so awesome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. I want to jump right into AI, but I guess we should first do some like brief introductions. Kenny, I guess I wanted to ask, where are you from originally, and what was it like growing up there?
By the way, I'm not me. I'm an AI bot. I'm hilarious too. The jokes are as bad. They very well could be AI.
You better prompt them right, John.
AI's jokes are better than ours. I take offense at that.
I've actually used them in my writing, so I can't argue with that. And for writers that say that AI can't write and could never write a creative, powerful piece of work, that's absurd and complete bullshit. Like all the Hollywood writers, strikers, etc., with all respect for their wage desire to get
normal wages. Wait a minute, Kenny, you're a scab?
Huh? No. I'm a scab, but not in relationship to striking workers. Just in life. That shut everybody up. No. I'm from Long Island, to answer your question.
It hit too close to home, and we're all like, me too.
You can't, I don't think that's a good choice of words, actually.
Right. Hey, there's no union for AI artists.
Yeah, what is GPT for some alternatives?
That's a good point. Not yet, but there's going to be a lot of lawsuits of people fighting to get a stake.
That's right. All right, guys. Well, hey, AI John, we're handing over the mic to you, brother. And this is John Barrymore. He's one of our AI artists. He's OG to AI Art Today as my first co-host. And so, John, I pass it over to you.
Hey, okay. You said you're from Long Island. Did you go to art school?
Nope. The first art class I was in, I was teaching. After a gigantic 40-ounce Budweiser I consumed.
I watched one of your interviews, and you said you had studied philosophy. I guess I wondered, like, what branches of philosophy you had gotten into.
Well, it was just a general... I can't say I'm erudite enough to speak on particular branches of philosophy. It was a general undergraduate degree, but I read Hegel and Kant and Kierkegaard and Sartre, all the obvious ones.
No, that's great. Okay, I guess another thing I took from that interview is you said that the Warhol estate sale, it had like a big effect on you. Like, could you describe like the before and after, the art world before and after the Warhol estate sale?
Well, there was no art world before the Warhol estate sale for me, which was in April of 1988, probably before a good chunk of you were born. But I grew up, even though it was 15 miles from New York City, it could have been another planet. It was so isolated and so alienated in upbringing that I had for various personal reasons. But I call myself idiot savant. I had, not only did I not know there were galleries existing until I was well into my 20s, I didn't know that you could sell art. I was never taken as a child to a gallery, obviously, or a museum for that matter. When I was in college, I would procrastinate, get high, and go to the East Wing of the Smithsonian, part of the National Gallery. And there I saw contemporary art, and it didn't really register with me, but it seeped in somehow into my subconscious or connected with some urge to be creative. And when I was again procrastinating, which is a regular theme in my life, I call it procrastinating, I was basically stumbled into the Warhol estate sale at Sotheby's in between jobs. I went to law school just to buy, I needed more time to figure out what I didn't want to do and what I did possibly want to do. So when I went into the sale, that was the first time I ever saw. I was no fan of Warhol at the time, and like kind of reminded me of my reaction to the punks when I first saw them. I didn't just dislike them, I despised them. And then I came to grow to understand and appreciate them and even like them. And I went to Warhol expecting cookie jars and jewelry and watches. And it was not only his vast collection that he had traded with his contemporaries with and for, but it was also Sotheby's gearing up for their yearly spring auction. And then all the works I had seen in the museum, Twombly, Warhol, Basquiat, all these contemporary works, I saw actually could be bought and sold. And it was a revelation and an epiphany shortly after I saw an ad for an exhibition in a gallery, went into the gallery. It was for an exhibition of Cy Twombly, Sigmar Polka, and Joseph Beuys, and fell in love with art and the notion that you could actually own it, which was completely alien to me before that. And then I went to Chase Manhattan Bank and asked them for a loan to buy some art. They turned their head sideways like a confused dog, obviously said no and nearly called the police. And I just got a part-time job working for a law firm. I somehow managed to pass the bar. And I had the manager of the firm call the bank. I got the loan. And I immediately began dealing, sell like a dealer to other dealers. So that's really how I got my start into art and then began making it at the same time.
Thank you for that. Because you've seen the before and after, actually, could you talk about like the mega dealers, seeing the rise of the art advisor or private museums? Because I'm guessing these things didn't exist before. So like, what's it like seeing them now?
Well, I mean, that's a pretty awful and boring, horrible question. Not your question, but the content in terms of art advice. It's harder to be a hairdresser than it is an art advisor. So, I mean, that word is bandied around and abused as much as the word curator. We could do away with all those words and manage to survive quite healthily and robustly in society. But, I mean, I'm a person who hates private museums because I think they're mainly and primarily tax dodges for hyper ultra wealthy people. And either there's a private museum in a city like Los Angeles, which is atrocious because there's extraordinary institutions like MoCA and the LA County Museum and the Museum of Contemporary Art that have spent decades building constituencies. And then someone like Eli Broad comes into town, buys loads of art at night sales at Christie's and Sotheby's and opens up a museum, and it's a zero-sum game that sucks away attendance from these great long-standing academic institutions. So for me, primarily private museums are academic kind of institutions with no scholarship, mainly set up for tax dodges. And then there's another very famous one, Glenstone in Maryland, in the outskirts of Maryland. You have to bend over backwards and do a few flips before you can get an appointment to visit. And it's in nowhere. And that money, they have an endowment bigger than the Metropolitan Museum because of the richness of the entrepreneur that owns it, who also buys and sells at auction regularly. And I just think that, I mean, it's not for me to say, it's a free world, but that money would be way better spent donated to a proper museum. And I mean, I think the only time private museums do make sense is in obscure jurisdictions or someplace in China where there isn't much, if any, state support to showcase contemporary art. So in China, it's the opposite. They're crucial. No, but I put everyone to sleep.
No, that was really good. Thank you. I feel like you addressed like the state of the art world really well in your NFT project, Pot Principle. Can you talk about that? I thought it was really good the way that you kind of highlighted these art world figures or, you know, characters that have all this attention.
Well, I mean, I've been in the art world for over three decades, going on probably close to 35 years. And I'm, like I said, I'm self-taught and I love art and I love the art world in a perverse love-hate way. When I started in the traditional art world in the late 80s, I caught the tail end of a gigantic speculative, probably the first ever speculative explosion in contemporary art with like Julian Schnabel and these neo-expressionists gaining traction and hitting prices at auction of like $100,000, which was a new paradigm really for contemporary art. And then within 2 years, the market didn't just constrict in a recession that lasted for half a decade, the market evaporated completely. So when I was curating shows, I began curating exhibitions with my peers, with other artists, they were pop-up shows before the word pop-up even existed, We called them hit and run shows or guerrilla shows, and I would barter, beg, borrow, or steal to get spaces in Soho before the art world moved to Chelsea and now Lower East Side and Tribeca. And I would stage shows with young artists and put my work in it. That was the only way my work could be seen. So in a way, there's so many parallels to NFTs and where we are sitting right now, or pacing in my case, because I've always been a do-it-yourself kind of person, as much by choice as by necessity, because it's the only way for me to ever get my art seen was to create the context myself. And that's what I do to this very day. And it's the same kind of struggle, the same kind of hustle, but there's certainly more opportunities that I get due to this work that I've been doing nonstop and loving. And in the beginning, when there was a deep recession, there were incredible conversations, incredible communities of artists that formed together. And no one stops making art when the market collapses, although some do, many do, especially in this kind of NFT downturn that we're in. So many people would like to see NFTs go away, especially in the traditional art world, and never stop talking about the fact that they have or will, which is complete absurdity and bullshit, because smart contracts in the blockchain in relationship to digital art is nothing short of a revolution that can't be put back into the bottle. It's the first time in history there's a mechanism to buy and sell art and put digital art, which is the art of our time, on some level of parity with painting and sculpture, which hasn't changed since art came off the wall of a cave. So in any way, when there were terrible times, great things happen and great people continue to plug away, because that's all, but it's not even by choice. That's what we do. We make stuff, we communicate with each other, and we can't stop because the money dries up. That's ridiculous. A lot of people will walk away from it because they were in it for the wrong reasons from the start. Anyway, there was more growth in the contemporary art world in the last 25 years than in the previous 250 years. And unfortunately, the conversations, if any, have completely shifted away from art and people caring about and helping each other, and shifted towards money conversations and basically cottage industry, entrepreneurs jockeying for position in the market. And that's just so boring and not what I signed up for. I say I ran away from big business by going into art, and then it became bigger than the business I was running away from. And when I started with NFTs 3 years ago, I showed my first digital animation in 1993 in an exhibition I curated. Then I went on to make like giant computer prints on vinyl with elements painted into them in the 90s. So I always incorporated digital means, not because I'm a technologist per se, but because contemporary art should reflect the times we live in, and those are the times we very much live in. And in the beginning with NFTs, I got the same feeling, the same vibe, the same conversations that I was getting when I first started in the art world, which was people being generous with their time. I had people mentoring me because I took 2 years off my traditional art writing and career to learn deeply about crypto, because I hated crypto before I found that it had a practical application to art. Before that, for me, it was just another money system. And those things are more about corruption than anything else, and enriching people, typically unjustly or unfairly. Anyway, and then I just fell in love with the whole spirit of somebody gave me an Ethereum to get me away from minting with Nifty Gateway, because they keep the keys. That's not even really an NFT. They just make the NFTs for themselves, and you have ownership through their custodial account. So someone, Ethereum was 1600 2 years ago, and someone just gave me one, someone I barely knew. I had people mentoring me to learn about the digital space, someone from Google, another one, George Bach, who's a historian of generative art. And I just love the generosity of spirit. And that's something anyone who's not too bored to death by my long-winded answers and has questions for me now or anytime until I die, people can contact me on DM and Twitter and Instagram. And within 24 hours, usually, I get back in touch. And if I can help people, I feel almost it's my responsibility and my pleasure to do so. So I think I miss that kind of camaraderie in the art world that I found in NFT space before that even stopped. And So this RP, this I didn't forget the question. That work was about, in the beginning, it was about this war between the crypto space and the traditional art space, which is as crazy and vehement as it ever was. But it was going to be that, a pitched battle of crypto artists versus traditional artists and figures in the art world, which I had done something like that before, which was really violent and aggressive. It was conceptual and tongue-in-cheek, but there was a lot of bloodshed. So I changed it to be more like paintball guns and less fatal. And then I just thought, really, in the end, what is the crypto world copied the worst aspects of the art market, and it's all just a clusterfuck of a popularity contest. So in the end, it was the piece you refer to, Pop Principle, ended up to be like, who's the most popular person in the crypto world and the art world? And there were figures from Gagosian and Rafik Anadol to Hans Ulrich Obrist, Jerry Saltz and Paris Hilton, and various artists from both spaces.
No, okay, thank
I'm
you.
I'm exhausted.
No, you're good. Actually, one more, like, I guess, like, on a personal note, I guess. What has it been like navigating between the NFT space and the art world? Like, what's, like, the language barrier, culture clash kind of that goes on when you're trying to, yeah, I guess, like, work in both spaces?
Well, I think it's very depressing, to be honest with you. And it's pretty frustrating because, I don't know, people... I hate generalizations about anything or anybody, but the art world is the most conservative, backward-looking industry in the world. I've worked in finance. I've worked in fashion. I've been a lawyer for the stock exchange, and nothing prepared me. I was expecting the art world to be a bunch of people swinging from the chandelier, drinking absinthe and going to orgies, and I couldn't be more misplaced. It was more like the insurance company Lloyd's of London in the 18th century of rich white men sitting around shaking hands, doing deals, and artists just jockeying to get position in this very retrograde system. So, but there's so much animosity and disdain in the traditional art world for NFTs. The only word that's more embarrassing to say today then the metaverse is NFTs. It's terrible. And like Vera Molnar just had this amazing drop the other day. She's 99 and made these extraordinary NFTs, and they did really well because they're good. And that's the way it should be. So for me, I don't differentiate between a painting, a sculpture, a fork, a knife, a car, or a great artwork. Something good is something good. And the content, how it's made, the process, I should say, is irrelevant. So whether it's an NFT, which, I mean, the Vera Molnar piece was basically NFT art, which a lot of people say doesn't even exist. That's ridiculous. The art she made was art that the NFT is part of the content.
No, definitely. One time, can you define NFTism and post-NFTism?
Well, NFTism is just what I've been talking about. It's the sense of collaboration, community, people communicating with each other, conversations, collaborations, people working together, people not at each other's throats in this competitive, you know, death match, and people supporting each other, people being generous with their time and their resources, helping each other, and caring, simple humanistic things. That to me is life as much as NFTism. And because some people, even some veterans that are, you know, major players in the NFT space will say that NFTs are a marketplace. NFTs, that's ridiculous and such a reductive, narrow-minded notion of what we're doing now is NFTism, because it's 9 o'clock in the morning on a Friday in the summer. And I've been frustratingly trying to switch phones because my phone is dying. And it's taken me over an hour. And then I get on with you and sharing my thoughts and communicating with people, if not putting them back to bed or boring the shit out of them, talking to people and sharing ideas. And this whole relationships could be created from this conversation. Post-NFTism is what I just described, how in such a brief period of time, the utopian idealism of all these things I just described turned into a giant scam fest where everyone is fucking each other, if you put in the word spleen or toe next to PFP in Google, you'll get 10,000 pieces of crap that were created as substitute securities to turn a quick profit. And again, this is no different from people buying and selling 25-year-old artists' work for $500,000 that they've owned for 45 minutes and never taken out of the crate. And this kind of greed, it's human impulse. It's not, and back to like, to touch upon AI, which was the basis of this conversation, people are up in arms about AI, that it's going to destroy the world, literally, and all this crying out for regulation. I never met a dishonest computer in my life. I mean, I was just hacked. I fell for some stupid scam, which was careless, and I lost $5,000. It's my fault. It was very upsetting and unsettling. But that kind of impetus and impulse of people is sad and unfortunate. But it's not AI that's going to destroy the world. It's we, the people. We're going to kill each other. It's 100 degrees in New York City today. It's the hottest July ever. If you go into the sea anywhere, it's like going into a boiling tub of water. And we're killing each other. It's not the computers or AI. Those are tools for growth, used in the right way, make life better.
Definitely. Actually, I wanted to ask about the installation that you did at Expo Chicago, where you used ChatGPT.
Yep. And DALL-E. I mean, I've written two articles using ChatGPT, and as we said, if anyone is still here from the beginning of this run-on sentence that I've been sprouting, I wrote about Freeze LA, and I didn't go, and I thought it'd be funny to like let ChatGPT go instead of me, and I asked it to write with a sarcastic kind of parodic form, a little cynical, like I typically write about the art world. And it came back, and I did it I put a couple of different prompts in. I got a few paragraphs. I went and rewrote them entirely to the extent that ChatGPT couldn't recognize that they initially came from ChatGPT, and not to dismiss it, because it came up with some extraordinary jokes. One of which I remember was about Freeze Art Fair. There was so much to look at, but all I could focus on was the exit sign. And it was great. I wanted to steal these jokes, and I almost did, but my editor flagged them out that they had been done by ChatGPT. And I just wrote an article on AI for a Turkish newsletter. I'll publish it on Twitter in the next day or two. And I used AI, and to make a long story even more laborious and tedious, I was thinking of a joke to make a metaphor about penguins in this sentence, and I couldn't quite nail it. And then I just kept asking ChatGPT to make a joke about AI, and it made a joke employing a penguin, which was eerie. And it wasn't like anywhere on my computer. I mean, if you could be a conspiracist and think that it's reading my actual brainwaves, but I mean, it's like when I would go to different studios 30 years ago and see artists making the same work simultaneously without being aware of each other doing so. In a way, like ChatGPT is scraping human knowledge from the internet and various other inputs. And the thing is, we're all the same species. We like to think of ourselves as special and different and uniquely creative, which we all are. But like these systems are dealing with the same levels of inspiration and input, I should say, or making the same associations that we make based on input that humans have done. So I don't even like to call it artificial intelligence, because it's an extension of human intelligence, and there's nothing artificial about it. It's all man and woman made.
Yeah, exactly. I feel the same way when you watch some of the AI videos. It is reminiscent of dreams. But you had mentioned the writer's strike and the Hollywood strike. Do you have a take on that? Like, do you think the studios should have the right to to actors' likeness in perpetuity? Or do you think that's ridiculous? Or
that's criminal. That's fucked up. That's just fucked up. In the same way that I made a joke that this is not me, this is AI. But when you think about, like, the first demonic criminal usages of this technology are, like, people calling up their parents, like children calling their parents for money in desperate need in some emergency, and it's AI fabricated voice. I mean, you have what's called legally your right to privacy, meaning like the ownership of your identity, both on and offline for reproduction, etc. And I think it's stupid to be against ChatGPT and the systems that are like it to help to facilitate scripts and stuff. But I think that I use in my writing so far, I've used these tools as a tool. Like in the same way, I remember when I was in law school, I bought the first available computer for the home, which was a giant IBM desktop with a floppy disk. And I've always loved technology, but never really, I'm not a programmer and I'm not a coder, unfortunately, nor can I paint for that matter. I just can think up ideas sometimes, not enough time. But in the same way that when you first put your eyes on word processing, it changed the way you write by being able to move sentences around and paragraphs. And it fundamentally changed the notion of how to edit and how to structure text. And in the same way, these new systems help to augment our way of creating words and images, but it's not detracting from the individual impetus to writing a prompt. Will be like being a great prompt writer, will be like being a great carver or wielding a brush. So it's just progress, or even just the unfolding of technology. And you can't, it's not as black and white as being right or wrong or good or bad. There are all those aspects figure into it. So I think that people should be paid for what they do, but writers can use, are using these things in new unfound ways, and they will continue to do so. And why should they not? And I think that strike is more about fighting for fair wages than it is about losing the right to owning a likeness of yourself. But that's just wrong. Unless you get paid like $1 billion, if you're Tom Cruise or something, to do so, and it's in your interest and you willfully do so, then it's fine. But if you think about like the music industry in the 60s, where artists were getting raped and losing, like by unscrupulous people, losing income streams from their hard work and labor, that's just wrong and immoral. So I think anything, there's a bell's curve of morality and integrity in the world. And, you know, there are clearly right and wrong ways of doing things in relationship to what we're talking about and everything else.
It seems like you're not impressed by royalties and NFTs, but do you see promise in royalties for AI? Like if an artist develops a custom model or prompt or something like that, do you think that they should get royalties every time it's used?
Well, again, like I don't speak in what's the word? Like superlatives? No, that's not the right word. I mean, I just speak for myself. I just have my own stupid opinions and they apply to myself, and I'm contradicting myself on a regular basis. So what I say is not always like in stone, that's for sure. I'm sure I'll contradict myself before we're finished here. But I think if you do something that's individual to you creatively, everyone has a right to royalties. I just think the only reason in a 2-hour interview on NFT Now, in the last 1 second, they have these hot takes where you're given like 10 seconds to comment on something. And I said, royalties are stupid, and it created a maelstrom. And I got a lot of hate mail from it. People criticizing my age, my brain, my sanity. But the fact is, let's be frank, generally speaking, royalties benefit those that least need it. People that are successful, that have a secondary market. I mean, yeah. So in a way, that's a system which is self-affirmed success, which is generally the whole underlying rules of the art world, that when you're successful, people want not only the artists that have already been a proven success, but they want the same exact artwork within which they achieved and accomplished that success. So I think, I mean, look, anyone that does something that's copyrightable, or, I mean, again, like, I'm of the Richard Prince, the appropriation artist school of thought. Richard Prince said he doesn't believe in the little C with the circle around it, because he made his career re-photographing cigarette ads and cropping them. And he said it changed the way photography was done, because photography was always catching a fleeting moment, a non-fixed moment, unless you have someone sitting in front of you. And even then you get different expressions and different manifestations. But when he put a photograph in front of a camera, it changed the entire notion and definition of what a photograph could be and was, because it was a fixed image that he could leave for 3 hours and come back to. And it was exactly the same content that he was photographing and controlling. So I make all my work. I just minted a stupid thing this morning on object.com, and I elect Creative Commons, which is not taking a copyright in anything I do. I remember when I first did this about a year ago or so, I made a work and then Kevin Abash copied it, just outright copied it, and he made more money off of my artwork than I did. And I think it's kind of funny, a little bit annoying, to be frank, but if you do something and you do it well and you have belief in yourself and confidence in your ideas, I always believe in, like, karmically somehow you'll grow your audience and it'll come back to you. So I think if you create prompts that are unique and special and that's your livelihood, and you're positing something that's yours and your intent is to make a living off it, you should be able to have control over it if that's your intent. I personally choose not to. I make what I make. I put it out there. And if I benefit from it, good. And if I don't, it's not going to stop me.
Thank you. And sincerely, I didn't know people were getting at you about the NFT Now interview. I just...
Oh, my God.
That's funny.
It was brutal.
I guess I want to ask the bigger AI artists like Rafiq Anadol, Claire Silver, I guess Tyler Hobbs, I don't know if it's generative or AI art, but do you like them? Like, do you like the artists that are kind of in front right now leading AI art?
I mean, I respect everybody. Like, I think you can't become a Rafiq Anadol or a Beeple or a Damien Hirst or a Jeff Koons. You can't just will that. You can't just say, I want to be stinking rich and successful and then go about making work to do so. I think that these people are all in. The impetus of all their work was from, you know, crazy dedication, perseverance, and talent and brilliance to some degree. I think, like, what someone like Damien Hirst has done to just continually capitalize on his fame and commercializing his work has really detracted or diluted the quality of the work by just grabbing for every available dollar. Is not the best strategy, especially, I mean, when there's no reason to, when you already have untold success. I think, like, I mean, Rafiq Anadol is obviously brilliant. I've made fun of some of his work and made a piece where it's a cat looking into a washing machine, and then you see one of his signature lava lamp type images in the middle of this washing machine. And I mean, I just think, again, like, when you do something successfully, the art world does not encourage experimentation. Everybody wants the same shit that they've seen before, that everybody likes and their friends have hanging on the wall. And that's unfortunate that people don't take more chances in life, in art, and especially the market, which again just wants more of the same. And when you go to an art fair, it's 96% painting, so repetitive and so dull that any given art fair, Basel, could be 50 years before, and it would be absolutely plausible. So, I mean, I think some of those artists you mentioned are fine, but I just wish they would say no, for Christ's sakes. No, I'm not going to do another lava lamp installation. Like at MoMA, where Rafiq has had this hugely successful work, I went to see it and I was trying to have an open mind, and he took chunks of the Museum of Modern Art collection and crunched it through his AI, but he also attached the lava lamp aesthetic thing. And I went to see it and I couldn't even get through the lava lamp, and I never ended up seeing the part of the work that I wanted to see because it was just crowd pleasing and massaging the expectations of a general public with the museum trying to create like an amusement park ride. And yeah, so look, everyone should do what they want. I'm not one to tell, I'm not the art police and all the power to all these people, but I just find some of the things that get, you know, affirmed in the market become a little bit emasculating.
Just because you said that part about amusement park, how do you feel about all the immersive art that's going on, like Meow Wolf, Team Lab? There's other people, like, I guess they're the best ones.
I mean, like, again, I'm sure there'll be masterworks. I mean, a good example is someone like David Hockney, who's like 80, 180, whatever he is. I love his paintings and his art and his iPad drawings and his photography, everything he does. But I guess everyone hits the wall eventually. And someone asked him what he thinks of NFTs, and he said they're for low-level criminals, not even good criminals. And I think it's such a stupid, myopic attitude from someone with a very open mind. And if I ever explain to a layperson, which is pretty much every day, what's an NFT when they turn their head sideways, I always use David Hockney as an example. He's been making iPad drawings since the advent of the iPad, which was brilliantly progressive for an artist of any generation at that time. And would you rather own an outputted photograph from Pace Gallery for 50 grand or 100 grand, 30 by 40 inches photograph? Or would you rather own a high-res file that he created the work in initially, and then you could project it, get it painted by a computer, get it, you know, leave it on your phone, make a light box? You should have that option because the work was created on an iPad, and that is the perfect example of what an NFT could be. He also did an immersive room, and I haven't seen it, but I'm sure it's pretty cool. I think a lot of them, when you reduce art to just mere, like if you take a Van Gogh painting and make a Van Gogh room or a Monet water lily room, I think it's just kowtowing to the lowest denominator. Art, especially Van Gogh or Monet, these were painters of a certain time in a certain place. And that work is only truly experienceable standing in front of the work and looking at the brushstroke viscerally and seeing the texture, the composition, the colors, the immediacy of looking at art. And I think that art should always be seen in the way that it was initially intended to be. So David Hockney got on board with that project, and a lot of his work is digital, even though he stupidly dismisses a lot of the digital goings on or in the space. But I mean, those things are fine. I'm pacing around in my bedroom because I was trying to get a better Wi-Fi signal when I was updating my phone, which is a pretty fucking frustrating thing to have Apple own you by your balls or whatever other organs you have. It's terrible. But I'm surrounded by very indiscriminately or democratically or non-hierarchically, which are all extremely important issues to me. I'm surrounded by everything is small. Nothing is terribly valuable. Little paintings, little sculptures, little objects, multiples, prints, drawings, all sorts of things. And this, to me, gives me sustenance and solace. And it enriches my life. It reduces anxiety. It's medically, clinically proven. Lowers blood pressure. Makes you less depressed, literally and provably. And I'm all, you know, so that's just box office. And if it's done with serious intent to be experienced in that way from the onset, well, that's great. And I'm sure there'll be experiential masterpieces. To be honest, I've never been to one, and I'm not really too anxious or bothered to go. I would if I would see David Hockney's one. I'm not even sure of what the Meow Meow, whatever it's called, what they do or how they do it, or Team Labs. I've never seen them. I'm willing to, and I would never dismiss them. But for me, art is different things for different people. And like I said, when the dedicated devices for the display of digital art need to improve so that living with digital art is you have the same ease and simplicity of all of this shit that I'm looking at, all the crap that I'm surrounded with in every corner of where I live. And it just, when I'm down and depressed and feeling really awful, which has been a lot recently, I mean, I was away for a while and I came back, and just to be swaddled by this stuff really enriches my life in an unspeakable way.
Thank you for that. Okay, I guess I have one more question before I take
before I pass out from boring myself to death.
No, you're great. What's it called? Can you please talk about Open Book?
Sure. I was asked to co-author a book on NFTs over a year ago by a scholar from Cambridge, and he was going to interview me, and then he just asked me to cover the breadth of my 3-year experience in the NFT space that would form the basis of half of this book. And I'm always writing about the ups and downs of the art world through art fairs and auctions and the way people are always zooming each other and screwing each other. And no one ever talks about the most, like when I go to give critiques at graduate schools, for instance, schools don't teach the class that artists most need to take, which is, what do you do the day after you get out of school? How do you formulate a life in art on a daily, day-to-day basis? Anyway, I was asked to recount my 3 years since I got involved with NFTs, and I just hit the wall. I'm always writing ahead, either what I just experienced or what I think will happen in the years to come. And the idea of just going back, looking backwards, I found so stultifying that I couldn't write a word, not even a sentence. And it was very difficult. And then I posted something on Twitter and said, anyone who wants to talk about NFTs, let me know. And it was like just on the tail end of COVID. And within 2 weeks, I had 20 interviews with random people. One woman escaped from a cult, literally. Another woman was in finance and loved art, but never wanted to be bogged down by physical things. So when NFTs began, she was able to jump in to start collecting. And just a wildly disparate group of people across all levels of the economic spectrum came to talk. And it was just, again, this kind of cool spirit of sharing and people engaging. And that's really what art is. Art is expression on one level. And then you can't have a Giacometti in the bushes, or a Van Gogh has no meaning, no use case, no functionality. Art needs to be shared and experienced. And we're a social being. I mean, I think that we're the only species that creates art in music, writing, poetry, art, etc., digital art. And that really distinguishes us from other species. But anyway, like this whole level of sharing and so forth, well, that helped me write my dumb section of the book that nobody's going to read. And the whole time, I just found it really stupid, because technology changes with a rapidity and velocity, the likes of which is quicker than the speed of sound, yet light, at a rate of transformation never experienced before in history. And the notion of writing a book about such a vibrant, transformative space, writing a retroactively looking account of it, made no sense. So then the idea just sprang into my head. I'd like to do a book that doesn't end, an open book. And with some of what I love about, like, and if, like, David Bowie said he was very pro internet at a very early stage when the internet came into popular use. And he said artists using the internet, like, conflates or decreases the space between the artist and the audience. And like getting rid of all these middle people, the galleries, the gatekeepers, sure, there's always going to be gatekeepers in everywhere, but like just more direct means of communication. I guess the most direct means would be the horror of Clubhouse, where that was a perfect example of how democracy, true democracy, could never function, because it was, everyone had a microphone and you couldn't hear anybody speaking. But Twitter Spaces, Discord. So when you make NFTs, there's this dialogue that never exists. I mean, I've had a situation where I've sold a work through a gallery within the past 2 years. And the gallery, and it was one of the most ambitious hybrid installations I ever made, incorporating video, painting, and NFT. And the gallery never even told me who bought it, which is not uncommon in the traditional art space. And when I sold my mockery of PFPs, crypto mutts, and 2 years ago, I'm still in the Discord on a regular basis talking with people. So the idea was to use this dynamic aspect of NFTs, which creates a new art form never before seen, which is art that changes over time. And then I had the idea, I gave a lecture for Async. They're very active with their First Supper project when they launched, and they created these dynamic forms of NFTs. So the idea is, again, collaboration, where I reached out to a broad group of artists and curators and asked them for some initial contributions. And I'm very self-critical, as you may have noticed, but I asked them, what do they love about NFTs, NFTism, and what do they hate about NFTs? And then I asked them to illustrate each couple of sentences with an image, and that constitutes the book. So it's a book where you can basically cherry pick the different artists that you like and make your own book. And then when I had an exhibition at a space in New York in the spring this year, I had sheets of paper where people can fill in their own opinions about these subjects. And then that got incorporated into the book. So the idea is that the book is ultimately in stages open to the public and never ends. Like my mouth.
No, that's great. I appreciate that. All right. Does anyone have a question for Kenny? Please request to speak. I guess in the meantime, I wanted to ask, I like Basira Khan. I'm a fan of her. What was it like doing that MTV show?
That was really shambolic and embarrassing. And I'm kind of sorry that I did it, because in the end, it was like a woke TV commercial. I mean, this is just between us and off the record. I see you're recording it, and I'm sure it'll be rebroadcast, but I just can't muzzle myself. It was just, it was unfortunately like a commercial for the Smithsonian Museum, for the Hirshhorn. And I felt they just edited it so much that they took away all the individual voices of the participants. I mean, it was fine, but those things are stupid and a narrow way to approach art. It could have been more fun and more engaging. And then it shows on like a network for babies, like MTV. If you turn on MTV at any course of the day, chances are you're going to find a TV show called Ridiculous. And it is ridiculous, stupidly ridiculous. And the Smithsonian Station, which is for people that are near the door of death. So, I mean, it wasn't streamed. It wasn't accessible to people. And it just wasn't fun in a way that should be ugly and exposing and make people vulnerable. And none of that was on it unless there was an easy, palatable thing, which would be the equivalent of clickbait. So, I mean, I have a hard time saying no, as you could see by me being here for the past hour. But I just, you know, I'm hopeful. I have a show coming up at the Francisco Carolinum in Linz, my first museum show. And it's called Keep Hope Alive. And I guess I could conclude with the fact that, I mean, I've had a really tough time economically and stuff over the past couple of months. And if I could give anyone any advice, if anyone even gives a rat's ass, it would be like perseverance and tenacity are the keys to any aspect of life, never giving up. And that's, I chose the name of this obscure racehorse in Ireland for the theme and name of the show. But I think it's applicable to me now and throughout my entire career.
Thank you for that. And congratulations on your first museum show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for listening and for asking me all these questions. I'm happy to take any questions now, or you could DM me for the rest of my life, because you all live longer than me.
Who came up? I think Travis, you came up first. You have a question for Kenny?
Hey, guys. Hey, Kenny. Thanks for chatting with us this morning. I was liking your stories.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about being in New York in 1988. And involved with the Andy Warhol thing. This is a pretty important time, maybe culturally, if we look back. Probably Keith Haring already has the Pop Shop. and Basquiat's already sold for over $100,000. And I'm curious if you think that we'll ever see some sort of cultural explosion like this from a location or art style. I mean, I feel like, you know, maybe this was kind of a interesting trickle-down effect where, you know, Warhol kind of co-signed all these young guys and they kept relevance or something. So I guess I'm curious if you see something like this ever happen again in our lifetime.
Well, I think you touched on a lot of really interesting things. Number one, I would say we're in the middle of a digital renaissance, the likes of which have never been experienced in history before. So I think at all times there's stuff going on, and I think we're living in among the most extraordinary. I've been in this field for 35 years, and the last 3 years have fucking upended my entire life to such an extent. I have the dumb, embarrassing tattoos on my arm. I'm marked for life, and not one day of my life has been the same since I first heard those three ignominious letters that ringing in my ear, NFT and blockchain and crypto art, not just crypto money. But I think that's a change that was unfathomable 5 years ago. Or, you know, I guess NFTs went public like in 2017. But I think we're living in one of the most extraordinary times that in my 35-year career, I've never seen the likes of anything remotely like where we are. All the controversy, all the polemics, all these stupid assholes in the traditional art world writing off NFTs, and all the idiot, I forgot this blogger, there are two bloggers that hate NFTs and crypto, and the woman in ArtNet equated them with Beanie Babies and the demise of these stupid collectible fads and frothy bubbles and all this. Look, when Keith Haring was alive, he was absolutely written off for having the pop shop for the reason that he was fucking too brilliant. The only thing worse than being behind the time is to be too far ahead of the time. Democratizing art for kids is one of the most brilliant gestures I've ever seen in my life. I met Keith Haring. He was one of the first artists to go on record in an interview, funny enough, that he had AIDS. And I met him and he was so humble. And I briefly spoke to him and he was so inspiring. And what an extraordinary, profoundly influential and brilliant person. But like Warhol was, again, absolutely dismissed by the end of his life. He was on the Love Boat TV show, which was one of the cheesiest, lowbrow television programs on the planet. And Warhol was doing these Warhol was doing these portraits of these like horrible society people for 25 grand a pop in the end, because that was the only stream of income that he could make, because in his lifetime, his auction record was 250 grand approximately, but within a range of 25,000. And that painting that sold for 260,000, let's say 43 $1 bills, later sold for $43 million. And, you know, these people were persecuted commercially and artistically because they broke boundaries and paradigms. So I think, you know, it's always when you're smack in the middle of something, it's hard to get an objective overview of it. But I think the times we're in now are wildly extraordinary, and I've never seen anything like it.
Hey, Kenny, this is LaRock. I got a quick question. From your lens, coming out of New York, where did you see over the 30 years graffiti culture and writers culture? I would love your opinion on that. And then three funny quick questions. What do you think it is that makes Long Islanders so cynical? And what part of Massapequa are you near? And do you think Long Islanders will ever get the art of what an NFT could be? Thanks.
Well, you're probably going to have to repeat three quarters of those questions. But number one, Long Islanders, I don't know if, I mean, look, everyone always says New Yorkers are this, or, you know, people from Italy are this, or French people are this. And maybe there's an iota of truth in some of these stupid sweeping generalizations, but this type of mentality is more dangerous than anything else. But I mean, maybe because people are always hating, my kids to this day continue to mock me because of my Long Island accent. When I used to drink a lot, it would come out to the surface more. I lived in the UK for 15 years and I still wasn't able to shake it. So maybe the fact that, like, if you're from Brooklyn or the Bronx and people are always looking askance at you and making fun of you, it makes you hyper defensive. So maybe that has to do with it.
Let's go.
Long Islanders like NFTs because I'm one of them, and I'm by default the evangelist, for what a stupid term that is. But I think that's an unfounded generalization. What was the middle one? Oh, Massapequa. I mean, now everybody associates Massapequa with the serial killer. And my theory, which is neither here nor there, is that when you commit a crime like that, there should be a law, a statute that says no criminals should have their names and their deeds widely publicized. The first thing this serial killer is from Massapequa. I don't know if that's why you brought it up or you're from there.
I happen to bring it up because we had a recording studio in Massapequa through the 2000s, but there is a parallel. Yeah.
Well, anyway, I just think that if the first thing he said when he got to jail was, like, what's the news coverage like? If there was a moratorium against any publicity for any revolting, horrible criminals, that would really reduce serial killers by 20%. The first question, which I absolutely, because I'm sober now, I could remember, which was about writing and graffiti. It's crazy that, like, Keith Haring was making graffiti in subways. And of course, people that were smart enough to realize how fucking fabulous they were ripped them off the wall of the subway. But that kind of work has always been dismissed from the beginning, although things have radically changed. So art that is accessible and, you know, in this hierarchy of what constitutes real art, like, nothing will ever replace the value of a piece of stretched canvas or a cast piece of bronze, because it's the most conservative. Paintings are the most easily portable, even though NFTs are more portable and less onerous. But paintings are easy to put into storage, easy to stack, easy to put on planes and boats to move around if need be to evade taxes or whatever the cause. So I think, like, you know, graffiti, if you look at someone like, let's say, Banksy, who's this kind of like guidepost for that whole sector in terms of public awareness. But the fact that his market remains bulletproof and so strong anything good is art, whether it's the way you dress, the way you cut hair, the way you do anything. And I think that graffiti writers and this type of work, I love Banksy's work, or a good portion of it, not all of it, like anything. But I think that work in the snooty art world turns its nose up at someone like Banksy or other people like Invader, for instance. I live in New York City now, on what I call the lower Upper East Side. It's cheaper than Williamsburg. And in the most weirdest, incongruous place, there is like an Invader thing on someone's brownstone, an old New York City brownstone. It just doesn't make sense where it is. I made an art piece where I photoshopped an image where I'm on a ladder with a chisel looking behind my shoulder trying to chop it off the wall. But I just think, again, like, you know, most public art sucks. Like, most stupid, grandiose, expensive, giant art mainly just blocks the view, unless it's done in sympathy with the context and the environment, and it adds something to people's lives. And that's a hard thing to do. And, you know, tagging a train or building or whatever, and it's done well, it's fucking cool. And I love it.
Thanks, Kenny.
All right. Thank you for that. Kenny, do you have anything you want to plug or direct everyone to?
Nope, not chilling. Just here talking. And I think we've pretty much, I've talked myself out. But I just want to really, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for listening. Thank you for asking. And thank anyone who's withstood this onslaught.
Yeah. No, thank you for that. All right. Everyone, please follow Kenny. Follow everyone on stage. God bless you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thank you so much.